until an LED screen lights up within it. A message on the screen displays our names and today's schedule, with a clock reminding us that we have T-minus 2 hours until dinner. I would have preferred a window to that, I tell Suki, nodding at the mirror screen of stress. Hmm, is all she says in response, before opening her duffel bag and folding her clothes into our chest of drawers. I'm in no hurry to unpack, but Suki is making it clear that we're not about to break the ice and bond. I might as well fix up my side of the room with some reminders of home. I hop off the bed and grab my carry-on, unzipping the compartment that holds my photos and posters. I pull out the framed photo of me with Dr. Greta Wagner from the science fair 2 years ago and set it in a place of honor on my desk. Then use a couple thumbtacks from the desk to pin up my favorite poster of Albert Einstein sticking out his tongue. And then I unearth my most precious photo of all, from Persian New Year back when I was 14. My father is leaping over a blazing fire, per New Year tradition, a childlike grin on his face, while me, Sam, and Mom watch with our arms around each other, practically crying with laughter. It's an image that's always made me smile, until today. Nothing can make this place feel like home, not when my family is 1,000 miles away. And if I thought I had a solid plan up my sleeve to get back to them, Dr. Takumi's litany of rules and restrictions is forcing me to reconsider everything. I think I'm going to take a nap, I fib to Suki. Of course, there's no chance I'll fall asleep, but I need an excuse to turn away from her, to hide my face and let the inevitable tears fall.
7. Leo. How great is this? I circled the dorm room I share with Asher, surveying all the luxuries that I once took for granted. A comfortable bed, our own heating and AC unit, furniture that looks sturdy enough to withstand the storms. Who needs anything more? But someone has gone to extra lengths to make up for my sad lack of clothes, planting t-shirts and socks, boxers and swim trunks, khakis and sweaters into the chest of drawers, all in my size. I'd almost forgotten what it felt like to be taken care of until now. The thought of no longer having to fight for every scrap of food, every piece of cloth on my back, makes me feel 10 pounds lighter. I flop onto the bed, gratitude flooding through me. It's pretty cool, Asher agrees, rifling through his luggage. He starts unloading books and photos onto his desk, and I wonder if he'll notice that I don't have a single belonging to unpack. But if he does, he's polite enough not to comment. Were you as shocked as I was to get drafted? I ask. Asher gives a modest shrug. I mean, I definitely hoped to get picked, and once I became a fighter pilot in the Itzfahal, that's the Israel Defense Forces, I figured I had a shot. That was my plan even before the Europa mission, to become an astronaut by starting out as a pilot. His eyes cloud over. But now that we know they're having a robot fly this mission, I'm not so sure what I'm doing here. They can't leave it all up to an AI, though, I point out. What if there was a systems failure or a technical issue? I bet Dr. Takumi and the general still need at least one human on board with piloting experience. Asher nods, looking slightly more hopeful. Thanks, I need this. He glances down at the floor. You know how it is, not having a home to go back to. I know. I don't elaborate on how much I've lost. I'm sure my lack of belonging says it all. But I feel a pang of sympathy as I remember that the rising of the Mediterranean Sea pulled millions of homes underwater, giving Israelis no choice but to flee. I hope you make the final 6, I tell him suddenly. I hope we both get to go. Asher smiles. Me too. Asher and I step through the doors of the cafeteria into a hum of conversation and a cloud of tempting smells. 3 faceless utility robots are stationed behind the buffet counter, their plastic-coated synthetic bodies moving in unison as they prepare our dinner. I elbow Asher in amazement, and he lets out a low whistle. Yeah, this is different from home, all right. We join Lark, Beckett, and Katarina at our table, seconds before Naomi and Suki slide in. Naomi's eyes are red-rimmed, her expression wary, and I have the unexpected urge to reach across the table to make her smile. But her head is turned to the front of the room, where Dr. Takumi, General Sokolov, and the rest of the faculty are surveying the scene from an elevated platform. Dr. Takumi rises to his feet, and silence falls over the cafeteria.
"Good evening, finalists," he greets us. "I imagine right now your families are all in front of their TVs, watching the media coverage from today, and feeling immeasurably proud of you."
If only.
"However, our real work begins tomorrow," he continues. "During training, you will be expected to push your bodies and minds beyond your limits, beyond fatigue. This is what distinguishes astronauts from amateurs."
I sit up straighter, hoping Dr. Takumi can see the determination in my face. I won't be one of the amateurs. Whatever it takes, I won't let myself slip.
"Throughout this process, you will alternate between learning the skills needed for the arduous journey into deep space and those needed to survive and build a permanent home on Europa. Your focus is critical."
He pauses.
"The tools you learn down here could be precisely what saves your life up there."
The silence in the room seems to thicken at his words. He holds our gaze for one more moment, and then nods approvingly.
"And now, dinner is served. When I call your team name, take a tray and line up at the counter."
As soon as it's our turn, I practically shoot out of my chair. One of the utility robots swivels forward as I approach the counter. "Would you like the American meal, the Chinese meal, or both?" it asks in a genderless, mechanical voice.
Both, please?"
I watch in awe as the robot piles fried chicken with collard greens and cornbread onto my plate before handing me a second dish of mapo tofu and a bowl of shrimp dumpling soup. I can barely remember the last time I ate like this. For a while, the only sounds around me are the clatter of silverware scraping against plates as the six of us dig in, until Katerina leans forward.
"Did any of you see the new BBC documentary about Europa?"
"Yeah, my uncle showed it at the White House,"
Beckett says through a mouthful of food. I catch Naomi give a slight eye roll at that, and I stifle a laugh.
"Wasn't it amazing?"
Katerina raves.
"The coolest part was when they showed how Jupiter appears 24 times bigger in Europa's sky than our own sun looks to us. Can you imagine the view we'd get every day? I think that's what I'm most looking forward to, sitting out on the ice surface and seeing Jupiter right in front of me, looming large."
"It'll definitely put all of Earth's sights to shame,"
Lark agrees, an inscrutable expression crossing her face. "What I keep thinking about is the landing," I say, leaning back in my chair as I imagine it. "That moment when we're the very first to set foot on a whole other part of the universe. It's like we get to be Marco Polo, but on an infinitely bigger scale."
"Yeah, and the rocket launch,"
Asher joins in, his face lighting up.
"I've watched so many online and always wanted to be up there myself, strapped inside the flight capsule ready for liftoff. But I never pictured getting to go somewhere so far off the map. That's the most surreal part about all of this."
He glances at Suki, sitting across from him.
"What about you?"
There's a brief pause before Suki answers, her voice quiet but firm. "Getting away from Earth. That's what I can't wait for." I raise my glass to hers. "I'm sure we can all toast to that." But Naomi shakes her head, stabbing at a piece of cornbread with her fork.
"I don't get it. You guys are acting like this is a vacation instead of a draft. If we get picked, we could literally explode into flames before we even reach Europa, or wind up starving to death if the Athena fuel leak costs us our supplies. Or we could make it to Europa with no problem, only to get killed by the environment or something else."
She takes a deep breath.
"I just think we need to be a little more realistic."
"What, are you scared?" Beckett jeers.
"We should all be scared,"
Naomi says under her breath. I can tell there's more to her words than she's letting on, but before I can ask, Lark jumps in.
Look, risk is an inherent part of space travel, but that doesn't mean those worst-case scenarios will actually happen. I know the fuel leak sounds alarming, but SatCon is keeping a sharp eye on it 24 hours a day. And moving up the launch date ensures the final six should make it to Mars in time to salvage the supply ship. She looks at us intently. If there was ever a mission destined for success, it's this one. Europa is the first time we've had the collective brain power of all the international space agencies together on one project. You can trust that they're making this mission as safe as it can possibly be.
No matter what happens, it's still got to be better than staying on Earth and waiting to die, I remark.
Suki and Asher both nod in agreement, but Naomi gives me an incredulous look.
You can't be serious.
I am, and if you don't know what I mean, I smile sadly.
Consider yourself lucky.
She furrows her brow, about to say something more, when Lark clears her throat.
How about we end our first night on a lighter note? I want to see us become a real team, which means we need to start getting to know each other fast.
Why don't we go around the table and share a little something about ourselves?
When no one volunteers, Lark says, Okay, I'll go first. I was born and raised in Huntsville, Alabama, home of the U.S. Space and Rocket Center. That's what got me interested in space from an early age, and I studied engineering at MIT before joining NASA straight out of college. My first space flight was actually the final trip to the International Space Station. But when Dr. Takumi offered me the chance to help him develop the ISTC, I retired from space travel to join him here.
You were on the last ISS mission.
Naomi stares at Lark.
So then you were here training when the news broke about the Athena crew. Did you know? And that's enough about me.
Lark cuts her off with a short laugh. She turns to our teammate sitting to her right. Katerina?
Some of you might have seen me on the final Olympics, Katerina says with a fleeting smile. But what most people don't know about me is that I'm really good at math. That's part of what made me so strong on the ice. Instead of being nervous, I would focus on the number of rotations and the geometrical angles I needed to hit to land the perfect jumps.
As we continue around the table, I learn that Suki was the youngest ever engineering student in her university's history, after skipping multiple grades in pre-tsunami Singapore, while Naomi tells us about her prize-winning radio telescope invention. The more my teammates list their accomplishments, the more beads of sweat I can feel forming on my brow. How am I supposed to compete with this group?
By showing Dr. Takumi and General Sokolov that I'm just the swimmer and diver they need to survive Europa.
I remind myself, recalling Elena's words, if what she overheard was true, then I'm just as integral to this mission as the academics. Maybe even more. Beckett is the last of our teammates to speak, and when it's his turn, he glances around the table at each of us like he knows something we don't.
Interesting, isn't it, that each of us has the exact same strength as someone else on this team? Suki and Naomi have the same engineering and science background. Asher and Katerina are both math prodigies. And me and Leo are the swimmers. He cocks his head. You would almost think we're all being pitted against each other.
Lark tries to laugh off his theory, but it's too late. The six of us are already looking at each other differently. And at the thought of another swimmer here, all the food I just ate threatens to come rising to the surface. That was supposed to be my ace in the hole.
What if he's as good as me?
It's been over a year since my last swim meet or training session with my coach. I am far from competition ready.
What was your best race? I ask Beckett, trying to sound nonchalant.
The 400-meter freestyle.
Oh, I swallow hard.
Me too.
I should have known they would have more than one swimmer in contention here, with all the underwater elements involved in terraforming Europa. But in my excitement, I never even considered it. I just assumed it would be me.
Training day one kicks off with a crack of dawn wake-up call from our dorm room's interactive mirror, followed by a jittery team breakfast where, unlike last night, no one seems to have much of an appetite. And then, before I know it, we're following Lark to the elevator bay, to our first training session. The elevator dings as we land on the 6th floor. Lark sweeps through the lift doors first, leading us to a concrete wall straight ahead. Each team is running on a different schedule, so you can receive as close to individualized attention as possible during training, she says, glancing behind her to make sure we're all within earshot. Your first session today takes place on a life-size mock-up of the Pontus, the spaceship that will fly the final 6 to Europa. Lark presses the badge hanging around her neck to a quarter-sized symbol on the wall, and I hear a gasp behind me as the concrete splits apart. The wall juts open, revealing the gleaming white facades of space capsules and the outstretched arm of a robotic crane beckoning us forward. Here we go. Lark steps through the opening, and we follow her onto the mission floor. It's a vast expanse the size of an American football field, with a series of hulking, interconnected cylindrical structures running the length of the floor. The walls and ceiling are painted to resemble the pitch-black sky you'd see from the windows of deep space, while a futuristic blue light offsets the darkness. General Sokolov steps out of one of the capsules, dressed in a red flight suit, adorned with mission patches and insignia.
"Good morning, and welcome to the Pontus," she announces. "What you see before you are the capsules, modules, and nodes that make up the most cutting-edge spaceships ever built, the Final Six's home base for the duration of the journey to Europa."
I turn to Asher standing beside me, and we exchange an excited glance. This is getting real.
"Not only does the spacecraft transport you from point A to a very far-off point B, it also serves as a life preserver, shielding you from the deadly elements and punishing conditions of deep space. However, this very shield can easily become a weapon if you fail to understand how it works and what makes the Pontus tick. All it takes is one innocuous mistake. For example, failing to close the airlock doors securely, and you could be killed within seconds."
She lets those words hang in the air, the image of an explosive death lingering above us, before she leads the way to the first space capsule.
"In the coming days, you will face emergency drills to test both your understanding of the spacecraft and your ability to survive a crisis on board. So pay close attention as I walk you through the Pontus."
The general climbs into a giant cylinder in the shape of a spinning top, with 4 thrusters protruding from the bottom. We follow her inside, emerging into a glowing, blue-lit flight deck. 2 massive tablet screens hang from the ceiling, angled downward to face the 5 leather seats at the center of the cabin, all in the reclined position for liftoff. Another pair of seats rests in front of a glass cockpit, with an array of flight instruments between them, and an 8K electronic navigation display unfurling across the glass. As the 6 of us look around in wonder, General Sokolov strides up to the cockpit.
"While Sib will be piloting the spacecraft under my command, one of the final 6 gets to take this seat beside the AI and serve as co-pilot. Upcoming flight simulations will test your abilities and determine who is best suited for this role, as well as help us fill the other key posts for the mission. Lieutenant Commander, Communications and Tech Specialist, Science Officer, Medical Officer, and Europa Underwater Specialist."
Asher elbows me in the ribs, a grin lighting his face. He's sure to snag the co-pilot seat, and I know he must be thinking I'm a lock for Underwater Specialist. And I should be. It's the job I was born to do. But as Beckett flashes the general a confident smile, I feel a pang of worry.
"Most of the journey will be flown in cruise control, thanks to the new algorithm technology implemented in our flight computers and avionics," General Sokolov continues. "However, 3 key stages in the spaceflight must be executed manually, due to their complexity and the higher degree of risk involved. That would be the escape trajectory from Earth, the rendezvous with the Mars supply ship, and the landing on Europa. While Sib and the co-pilot keep us on course, we'll need two members of the final six to complete an extravehicular activity, or EVA, otherwise known as a spacewalk, and oversee the docking of the Pontus to the Mars supply ship. If anything goes wrong there...
We die,
Naomi guesses.
You die, the general confirms. But the remaining four will still be expected to fulfill the mission.
I hear Katerina gulp beside me, and I can feel the ripple of tension running through the six of us. But the general is already moving on, opening a round hatch at the back of the capsule and crouching under her hands and knees.
Follow me.
We crawl through the tunnel behind her, making our way from one equipment-filled module to the next, as she points out the functional cargo block that provides our power and propulsion, the utility hub that stores our payload racks and emergency supplies, and the crew quarters, where we'll spend most of our time on board, complete with private sleep stations, a galley kitchen, gym, a communications bay with a pair of large-screen desktop computers, and two bathrooms with space toilets. My pulse quickens as I take in our surroundings. I can picture myself here so clearly. I can see the shadow of my future self sitting in the communications bay chair. I can feel the pride and elation of delivering progress reports to Houston and the watching world. I know the choice isn't up to me, but in my mind, I'm already there.
There's something about the geometric design in here. Naomi speaks up, turning around slowly. The whole spacecraft reminds me of someone, actually. Of Dr. Greta Wagner's work.
General Sokolov pauses, looking at Naomi in surprise.
That's an astute observation. The Pontus was, in fact, a collaboration between Space Inc. and Dr. Wagner.
Naomi's face lights up, and she breaks into the first real smile I've seen from her yet.
So Dr. Wagner's involved in the mission? Is she coming here? Do we get to work with her during our training?
The general purses her lips.
I'm afraid not. While we are grateful for her contributions to the Pontus, we chose to end our contract with Dr. Wagner.
What?
Naomi stares at her.
Why?
She had some differences with the rest of the team, Sokolov says cryptically.
Before any of us can ask what that means, the general turns on her heel, moving toward a tube-like tunnel at the back of the crew quarters.
Now, through the passage straight ahead, we'll reach one of the most critical structures in the entire spacecraft, the airlock.
She pulls a lever, and the passage door shutters open.
You all go in first. I'm right behind you.
Beckett climbs inside, followed by Katerina and me, all of us forced to shimmy forward on our stomachs through the tight confines. I hear the sound of a steel plate shifting into place as the general closes the hatch, and then her voice echoes through the tunnel. The airlock is the last thing you'll see before exiting into open space, and your first stop upon returning to the ship from your EVA. As you move between the Pontus's controlled, breathable environment and the toxic realm outside, the airlock's pressure prevents the outside poisonous gases from entering our spacecraft. And as soon as you hang up your suit, the airlock mechanism automatically filters out those same gases. She pauses.
I'm sure now it's clear why a simple failure to immediately secure the door would get you killed.
Yes, the six of us respond in unison. We reach a heavy round hatch with six interconnected latches covering its surface. General Sokolov crawls past us and demonstrates how to work the rods to unfasten each latch until the airlock door swings open and we tumble inside.
Don't worry, this will be a lot more graceful when you're floating in zero G,
the general says as Katerina and Naomi smack into each other and Beckett hits the floor with a thud. The general looks up sharply as the last of our team, Suki, topples inside. Sokolov's eyes flit between the open hatch door and my teammate.
Didn't you hear what I said about closing the hatch, Suki?
Suki's face strains of color.
Yes, I did. And yet you were the last one into the airlock, and failed to follow my express command.
The general's voice is ice cold. I have a sinking feeling in my stomach as I watch her stare Suki down.
But it's only because I thought you were going to—
The general grabs Suki by the shoulders and pushes her toward the hatch. Go back in the tunnel. Suki eyes the general nervously, but does as she's told, crawling through the hatch. Once in the tunnel, she presses her hands against the open door, her mouth forming a question, just as the general slams the door shut from the inside, barely missing Suki's fingers. The airlock chamber turns dead silent.
What's going on?
Suki's muffled voice calls from outside the steel-plated door.
How do I get out of here?
You don't. The general says. Not until your next training period in 30 minutes.
What?
Suki's voice rises in panic.
But there's hardly any air in here. I won't be able to breathe.
Imagine that feeling magnified to the 100th power, General Sokolov says coolly. That is what will happen if you or any of your teammates use the airlock improperly in the vacuum of space. She turns to face the rest of us. You're all receiving a crucial lesson, one that will save your lives if it sticks with you. And then, proceeding as if Suki weren't trapped in a confined space behind the hatch door, the general moves deeper into the chamber, motioning for us to follow. But I can't concentrate. My mind back in the tunnel with my teammate.
I can tell Naomi feels the same way.
And as General Sokolov shows us the equipment block where we'll purify our spacesuits, I catch her sidling away from the group, edging her way toward the hatch door. What is she about to do? Instinctively, I take a few steps closer to her, while staying within the General's line of sight.
Naomi presses her face to the hatch and begins to speak.
Can you hear me, Suki? It's Naomi. We need to keep you relaxed and your pulse even. As long as you don't panic and deplete your oxygen levels, you have enough air in there to survive for more than double the time. Close your eyes. Let's see if we can trick your consciousness into falling asleep.
Something tugs at my chest as I watch her, risking a punishment of her own to help a girl she only just met. I glance behind me at General Sokolov, in the middle of demonstrating the spacesuit purification mechanism,
and I catch her gaze flickering in Naomi's direction, too. But the general doesn't react. She simply watches Naomi out of the corner of her eye,
while continuing with the lecture, an unreadable expression on her face. Lark is waiting on the mission floor when we emerge from the space capsule, and she zips us from the Pontus mock-up to our second training session on level 4. I can smell the chlorine even before the elevator doors open, and my muscles clench on cue. Time to compete. For years, this floor was home to the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, Lark says, taking us through a long white hallway. NASA engineers built an underwater mock-up of the International Space Station, and astronauts in training, like myself, would wear neutral buoyancy suits to simulate the microgravity of space while we practiced for our EVAs. But when the Europa mission was approved, Dr. Takumi had this place redesigned and repurposed for something else. Preparing the final 6 for the underwater operations necessary to terraform Europa for human settlement. She pushes open a set of double doors, and my mouth falls open. From the colossal pool and elevated diving boards to the dozens of countries' flags dotting the walls, it's like we're inside one of my old Olympic dreams. But when we step closer, I spot the differences. I've never seen a swimming pool this deep. It appears almost fathomless. And sitting about 50 or 60 feet underwater is a massive block of ice. The ice is covered in crisscrossing red ridges.
just like the surface of Europa. A man in a diving wetsuit crosses the floor toward us, and Lark gives him a salute before taking a seat in the stands.
Welcome, finalists. I'm Lieutenant Barnes, United States Navy SEAL, and Paddy Master Scuba Diver.
This is my moment. I straighten my shoulders, my adrenaline kicking into gear as he speaks.
As you know, the final six's first and most crucial task upon landing entails drilling through Europa's ice crust to reach the ocean and rocky surface beneath, the most Earth-like segment of Jupiter's moon, where we will build our human colony, he says. We need one exceptional leader and athlete to serve as underwater specialist and spearhead this effort, but the other five must become scuba-certified divers as well.
It has to be me. What are the chances that anyone else here can come close to executing the kind of deep dives I performed as a scavenger in Rome? I was tailor-made for this, my body built for it.
On that note, today we'll begin with a diving tutorial, Lieutenant Barnes continues. You all have bathing suits on under your uniforms, correct?
We nod, as Lark's instructions from last night suddenly make sense.
Good. Once I hand out your diving equipment and wetsuits, change out of your uniforms and meet me at the edge of the pool.
I'm about to tell him that I actually don't need any equipment, when it occurs to me that I might want to keep that particular trick under wraps until the right moment. I stay quiet as Lieutenant Barnes passes out backpacks filled with scuba tanks and rebreather sets, diving helmets and masks. And then, out of nowhere comes a whirring sound, followed by a series of beeps punctuating the air. We all turn in the direction of the sound, and find the lead robot, Sib, advancing through the double doors toward us. The sight makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand on end.
It must be here to evaluate us,
Katerina says, watching Lieutenant Barnes jog over to the AI.
And as the six of us exchange glances, I can feel an instant shift in the mood, an undercurrent of competition crackling between us now that Sib is here.
I already knew I had to be at the top of my game today, but this is starting to feel as high stakes as the Olympic moment I once visualized. I'm so preoccupied staring at Sib, straining to hear what it's saying to Lieutenant Barnes, that I fail to notice my competitor moving past me and tossing his uniform on the floor. It isn't until I hear Asher murmur, "What is he doing?" that I glance up and see Beckett climbing up to the 3-meter diving board.
Oh boy, Naomi cringes.
I hold my breath, watching as Beckett stretches his body in a pencil-straight shape, assuming a dive pose. His form looks good so far. And then he leans his head forward and lifts his legs, leaping off the springboard in a swan dive. His entry is flawless. My heart sinks at the realization that my edge is no longer mine alone.
You don't need to teach me that one, Lieutenant, Beckett boasts from the water. And though he's speaking to Barnes, his eyes are locked on Sib, making sure the robot saw. Lieutenant Barnes arches an eyebrow.
Noted. Does anyone else consider themselves exempt from this lesson, or should I continue?
The thumping in my chest tells me what I have to do.
I may not be a pompous jerk like Beckett, but right now I need to take a page out of his playbook. I have something to prove. I strip off my uniform and walk right past the 3-meter diving board Beckett chose, climbing up to the 10-meter instead. I hear someone say, "Oh, God." And it's the last thing I hear before my body tenses, my muscle memory taking over, as I perform a twist dive from 30 feet high, somersaulting through the air before entering the water with a clean splash.
Nailed it. If this were a meet, I would outscore Beckett in both difficulty and execution. And this is what happens when you try to show the rest of us up, Beckett Wolf.
He climbs out of the pool with a scowl on his face, while our teammates gape at me.
I glance up at Naomi, who watches me with raised eyebrows and a half smile.
The thought that I might have impressed someone as accomplished as her makes my shoulders puff up with pride.
Well done, Lieutenant Barnes says at last, striding toward me with Sib at his side. You must be Leonardo Danieli.
That's me.
I hoist myself out of the pool with a grin. I'd almost forgotten how good it feels to do what I love, what I'm best at. For a second, I can almost imagine that I'm home, that Angelica and my parents are there in the stands, whistling and cheering my name, just like they used to at all my swim meets. But then I feel the heat of Beckett's glare, and am returned to the present moment. Something tells me he won't take this embarrassment lightly.
8. Naomi. With the morning we've had, I'm expecting our afternoon training to be a little more sedate, maybe even in an actual classroom, so we can sit and catch our breath after the past few hours of crawling through space capsules and diving into freezing water. But of course, my wishful thinking is way off base. It turns out that our most action-packed hour is still ahead of us. Our first clue is when Lark escorts us down to the first floor and through the main entrance doors, leaving the ISTC campus behind. A tram shuttle is waiting outside, and that's when she reveals what's in store. Today wasn't just about diving underwater. Get ready, because you guys are about to experience an in-air, parabolic dive. Lark's voice is brimming with enthusiasm, but her words fill me with dread. The vomit comet, I murmur. That's right. Lark grins at me, clearly missing the trepidation in my voice. We're going to take a parabolic flight around Houston on a special A500 zero-G plane. Once the plane reaches an altitude of 24,000 feet and an angle of 45 degrees, it will free fall in the air, which simulates the effect of being in orbit. So today, each of you will discover just what it feels like to be weightless in space. Awesome, Asher exclaims, fist-bumping Leo and Katarina. Suki gives a rare smile, and even the first nephew looks cheered out of his dark mood from the past hour. Are my teammates all adrenaline junkies or something? How am I the only one here freaked out by the thought of nosediving in a plane? My hands are already sweating, my pulse accelerating. I never could stand the feeling of my stomach dropping out from underneath me. It's the reason why I've sworn off thrill rides since I was a little girl, after a particularly hairy experience on the pirate ship at the Santa Monica Pier. Exhibit A for why I'm not cut out to be an astronaut. I keep my clammy hands pressed to my knees during the tram ride to the Space Center heliport, blocking out the snippets of conversation around me as I try to pretend I'm back with Sam and my parents, that I'm relating the story of this crazy thing we did at space camp from the safety of home. A gleaming plane with the zero-G logo painted in blue lettering waits for us on the heliport, its cabin door open and air stairs unfurled. My breath turns shallow as the tram skids to a stop and Lark directs us to the aircraft. Let's go! My teammates race up the steps and into the plane, free of the panic that holds me in its grip. I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. I don't... Come on! Lark nudges me forward. I'll be in there with you. I swallow hard and force one foot in front of the other until I'm inside the cabin. There are only a few rows of seats in the back while an empty, white-painted chamber takes up the rest of the space. I slide into an empty seat next to Suki as Lark starts passing out barf bags to store in our pockets. This is known as the vomit comet for a reason, so don't be too embarrassed if you throw up. One of NASA's medical officers is standing by in case any of you need extra attention, but most likely you'll experience only mild air sickness. And don't worry. The more you practice, the more your body will adjust. That's why in the days leading up to launch, astronauts will often complete up to 40 parabolas at a time. I squeeze my eyes shut, my stomach already roiling at the thought of the rapid ascent and plummeting drop ahead of us. It's nerve-wracking enough that we have to do this once. I can't even contemplate the idea of practicing 40 times in a row, as if free-falling in a plane is some kind of sport. We're about ready for takeoff, so sit tight and wait for the signal. Once we reach altitude, remove your shoes and follow me to the float zone, Lark says, gesturing to the empty white space stretching ahead of us. The wheels below us push forward, scraping off the pavement. Inhale, exhale, I instruct myself, though I can barely manage to take a full breath. The plane soars into the sky, the pilot steering us up a treacherously steep incline, and I grab Suki's arm involuntarily, desperate for something, anything, to hold on to. She squeezes my hand, her first friendly gesture since we became roommates. You'll be okay, she says, as our roles from this morning are reversed. I try to smile. Thanks. I meant to be a scientist on the ground, you know? I hate heights. I hate drops. This daredevil stuff is not exactly my strong suit. Well, someone must have thought you can do it, Suki replies. That's why you're here. A light flickers above our heads, followed by the sound of a chime echoing through the cabin. That's our cue, Lark shouts over the din of the aircraft. We're ready for our first parabola. Follow me to the float zone. The others spring out of their seats, all too eager for the real-life roller coaster ride ahead. Suki and I follow, my heart in my throat, as we step into the float zone and Lark instructs us to lie on our backs. I lie down next to Suki with Leo on the other side of me. As my body touches the floor, I realize how close he is, his skin just inches from mine. I turn my head in the opposite direction, a flush burning my cheeks. When the plane curves to the 45-degree angle, you'll feel a G-force of 1.8 times the Earth's gravity on your body, Lark calls across the floor. The best thing you can do at this point is stay still. Don't make any quick movements until the free fall. Oh God, she wasn't kidding about the force. I bite back a scream as the weight of gravity presses against my chest. The blood rushes from my head to my feet, and it feels as though someone is yanking my insides with a rope, dragging every part of me down to the ground. The plane's engine turns quiet. This is it! Lark shouts. Get ready for zero Gs! I grip the floor with my hands, bracing myself. The plane dips, and I gasp as the excess gravity weight melts off my body. Then, in one breathlessly quick motion, the plane plummets into free fall. My screams are all I hear, my terror is all I know, as our seven bodies rise up off the floor like the dead resurrected. We flail our arms and legs, grasping at air while the plane shifts yet again. And then we are floating. We are flying. A giddy sensation bubbles in my stomach. Something is happening to me up here, something I didn't expect. I am floating upside down, my feet touching the ceiling, and I don't feel like I'm going to die or even throw up. It's just the opposite. I feel as though all the weight in my life has been lifted and I am free. The chamber echoes with our intermingled whoops, shrieks, and laughter as the seven of us somersault through the air and float backward over the passenger seats. Leo drifts toward me as the plane dives yet again, and the two of us smack into each other on the ceiling. I burst out laughing, and he grins, impulsively taking my hand and twirling me through the air. I have always wondered what it's like to dance on the ceiling, he says with a wink. My stomach flips, and this time I'm not so sure it's from the zero gravity. I watch as Leo floats over to Asher, and then I lift my arms like a bird, skimming across the air to the main cabin and back again. After each parabolic dive, one or two of my teammates turns a shade of green and reaches for the barf bag. But strangely enough, it doesn't happen to me. My body is stronger than I thought. And as we plunge into our last parabola, I find that I can't stop smiling. It's hard to believe something so extraordinary, so magical, came from this experience I was dreading. Until the plane touches down, I am light as air. I am weightless. Our team returns to ISTC campus disheveled and delirious from the adventures of the day, all of us craving the same three things: shower, food, bed. But as soon as we step off the elevator and onto the HAB floor, those simple plans slip from view. A commotion is coming from the boys' dorm, a guttural cry that pierces at my chest. Lark breaks into a run and we race after her, stopping in our tracks when we see a group of five finalists clustered outside a closed door, their faces grave. What's going on? Lark demands. Diana, the British finalist I recognize from the TV segment on the 24, is the first to speak. There was a typhoon in Tianjin last night, where Jian Su's family lives. The reports are saying it's one of the most violent storm lashings China has ever seen. Her voice drops. The majority of the city is under the high river now, and they haven't found any survivors. I sink back against the wall, my heart breaking for the boy behind the door, for everyone in China. And all too quickly, my mind is picturing myself in Jian's shoes, hearing the same shattering news about my own family. What if L.A. is the next city hit by disaster, and I'm not there? The thought seizes me with fear, renewing my desperation to get away from here, to get home. Dr. Takumi and our team leader are in there with him now, the Australian finalist Callum says. We felt weird leaving without knowing if Jian's okay. He won't be okay. Leo speaks up, staring at the closed door. Not anytime soon. You don't ever get over something like this. The best you can hope for is to survive it. I look at him and it dawns on me. He must be speaking from experience. Leo is right, Lark says. We should give Gian some privacy. Why don't you guys go to the lounge and try to relax a bit? I'll wait here and see if they need anything. I doubt any of us will manage to relax after what we've just heard, but we trudge toward the lounge anyway. What else can we do? Only Beckett splits from the group, and I wonder briefly what he's up to, before turning to Suki, who's walking alongside me. Another city down. I shudder. I can't even imagine what Gian is going through. But Suki doesn't respond. She just gives me a sideways look before quickening her pace, as if she wants to get away from me. I watch her in confusion, wondering how her warmth from this afternoon could so quickly turn cool. Here's a thought, Katerina says once the ten of us are huddled up in the lounge. Is there anyone in this room who hasn't lost a family member to climate change? Does anyone here even have a safe home to go back to? One where you don't have to worry about waking up underwater or under rubble? When you think about it, we're all like Jian-Su. I glance around and I'm struck by the sight of everyone nodding or murmuring in agreement. Everyone but me. I thought being forced to move 3 times in the past 2 years was bad, but I'm beginning to realize just how fortunate my situation is in comparison to that of the others here. The fact that my family is still intact is even rarer than I knew, and the realization makes me all the more anxious to hold on to them. I don't even have a country to go back to if I get cut, Asher says, studying the floor. The flooding demolished most of the land. He looks up, his expression determined. Europa is my only shot. It's the only shot for most of us, Diana points out. She shuts her eyes. We just have to pray the right 6 are chosen and that the rest of us can handle the outcome. Someone stirs behind me, and I turn to see Leo push out of his seat, backing away from the lounge, away from this conversation. On impulse, I get up too, following him into the library. Are you okay? He keeps moving through the stacks, ignoring my voice until I reach for his arm, stopping him in the history of spaceflight section. Leo, what's wrong? I can't think about it, he blurts out. His eyes are haunted as he stares straight ahead, like he's somewhere else entirely and I'm not there. Can't think about what would happen if I had to go home. Why? I whisper. It's like being trapped inside my grief. He swallows hard, always waiting for them to walk through the door. Listening for voices that will never come. I couldn't do it anymore. A lump forms in my throat. I'm so sorry, Leo. You don't have to tell me anything else if you don't want to. I reach up to squeeze his shoulder, and his eyes refocus on me. I had a sister. The words come tumbling out, as if they've been bottled up for too long. Angelica, you would have liked her. She was smart, funny, the light of our family. A real firecracker, too. She could stand up to anyone and no one could match her wit. He smiles to himself, but then his expression falters. I wasn't supposed to ever see her like that. My baby sister underwater. Her face. He breaks off, unable to speak, and I close the space between us, wrapping my arms around him as my own eyes well with tears. I can hear his heart pounding through his shirt, can feel his chest rising with each hollow breath. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. And I know how you feel in a different way. We break apart and I lean heavily against the stacks. My little brother Sam is everything to me. When he was diagnosed with his heart condition and the doctors told us he was living on borrowed time, it nearly broke me, especially when we discovered it's from a genetic mutation, something I could have gotten to, but I didn't. I shake my head, the years of pain returning anew. I'm the big sister. It should have been me instead. Leo looks at me with understanding. We're supposed to be their protectors, not the survivors. Yeah, I whisper. Exactly. A clatter of footsteps echoes through the library as another group of finalists enters, jarring us from the moment. Leo and I step out of the stacks, a slight shyness between us now that we've both just revealed something so personal. But there's something else too, and I can see it in his eyes before we go our separate ways. It's the feeling of solidarity. Of finding a friend in the dark. I can't sleep that night, my mind spinning between thoughts of Europa and fears about home. It doesn't help that I've now gone my longest stretch yet without talking to Sam or my parents. I can feel the whole of their absence like a physical pain, a wound made sharper by worry. I never had to wonder before how they were doing, how Sam was feeling. I was always right there, close enough to know everything with just a glance. But now all I can do is guess. And the uncertainty has me wide awake. If I could just talk to them, if I didn't have to wait till the stupid scheduled video chat, then maybe I'd be okay. And that's when I remember the envelope from Sam. I didn't want to open it in front of Suki, but now that she's fast asleep, I have my chance. I throw off the covers and reach under my bed, grabbing the flashlight stowed there in case of storms. I tiptoe over to my backpack, the light's thin glow hovering above it, as I unzip the hidden compartment and pull out the white envelope. I tear it open, but there's no letter to be found. Instead, I'm holding a metal flash drive, one that I recognize. My heartbeat quickening, I shuffle through my backpack until I find my handheld tablet, the only personal electronic device we were allowed to bring to space training camp, since it works without a cellular or Wi-Fi connection. I power it on and plug in the drive, climbing back under the covers as it loads. A spinning alien head pops up on the screen, and I stifle a gasp. It's just what I suspected. Sam, you are one crafty little bro. The drive contains my own hacking software, the prototype I coded 2 years ago when I was desperate to access the Burbank Hospital computers. Sam was struggling to stay alive then, his heart fighting against the old medication, and I couldn't just sit and wait. I needed the internal data, the files and DNA sequencing that hospitals never release, just in case I could see something that the overwhelmed, scattered doctors might have missed. So I put my computer skills to their best use. I was already adept at Python, so it was just a matter of coding the server scripts, and then I was in. My software is how I hacked Sam's DNA records and figured out that he needed a biotech drug instead of a pharmaceutical, and it's what ultimately led me to come up with my DNA editing solution. But after that, I thought my hacking days were behind me. I haven't touched this flash drive since then, but my brother had the foresight to make sure I didn't leave it behind. The thought gives me a burst of excitement, even as a chill of fear runs down my spine. I know why Sam did this. He's counting on me to get the inside intel that could stop this mission and bring the 24 home. But would I actually dare to infiltrate NASA computers? On one hand, if my suspicions about the dangers and extraterrestrials are right, I would be protecting my fellow finalists. But after tonight, I'm not so sure they want to be protected. Is it at all possible that what's out there on Europa is the lesser of two evils? I drop the drive back into its envelope. I can't make any hasty decisions, not when the possibility of getting caught hacking NASA would land me in jail, maybe even for life. For now, until I decide what to do, the most important thing is to make sure the drive stays hidden.
9. Leo. The second day of training dawns, and we are thrust back into the ISTC's breakneck pace, with no more word from Dr. Takumi about the China tragedy. It's as though we've grown so conditioned to natural disaster that we can only spare one night to reflect before it's on to the next. Still, I can feel the shadow of last night's news hanging over all of us at breakfast, underscoring the urgency of our mission, as Lark talks us through the training day to come. My stomach clenches at the sight of Jian Su showing up to the cafeteria with puffy, red-rimmed eyes and a stricken expression. Both of us will have to harness our grief while we are here, to let it propel us forward instead of backward. After breakfast, Lark leads us through a series of corridors into the virtual reality lab, a vast space centered around a 360-degree video screen, its walls climbing with electronics and wires, the ceilings blinking with LED sensors and tracking cameras. Three swivel chairs sit in front of the screen, each with a joystick attached to an armrest. Stacked on each seat are a headset, boxy chest rig, and sensor-laden gloves. My fingers twitch in anticipation. It looks like we're preparing to infiltrate a video game. "Good morning, finalists." General Sokolov steps into the room through a rear door, an ISTC tablet glimmering in her hands. The six of us stand at attention, giving her the military salute Lark taught us to return her greeting. "Today, you're going to experience the most high-tech training system astronauts have ever received on Earth," she begins. "Once you're hooked up to the equipment and sensors, the software known as DUG, Dynamic Onboard Ubiquitous Graphics, we'll start modeling on the screen the very sights and scenes you'll find in space from your vantage point on the Pontus. At the same time, your headsets provide a 3D virtual representation, plunging you straight into the action
while your seats move in sync with the simulation. So, sitting in this chair and donning the gear will take you as close as anyone on Earth can get to deep space, without ever leaving this room. You'll find yourself surprised by how lifelike it feels.
Awesome. Asher and I exchange a grin.
Today's simulation places you near Jupiter orbit at the tail end of your journey to Europa, spacewalking during a pre-landing equipment check, the general continues. Three of you will be outside the pontus performing your EVAs, connected to the ship by a tether. You'll initially hear instructions from me through your headsets, but the purpose of the sim is to see how each of you reacts during an emergency scenario, one that just might require you to use your backup jetpacks. The corners of her mouth turn up in a conspiratorial half-smile. Your goal is to make it back to the airlock in one piece, with your teammates, by the end of the sim. The three of you will be able to communicate with each other via your headset radios, just as you will in a real-life EVA. Got it?
We all nod, though I can tell from the faces around me that I'm not the only one wondering exactly how this is going to play out. I watch as General Sokolov peers down at her tablet, giving it a series of swipes, and then the door behind us blows open, followed by the whirring and beeping sounds I recognized from yesterday. I turn around to the sight of both robots, Sib and Dot, marching toward the General at an eerily identical stride. The six of us step back, clearing the way for them, as their presence once again sends a jolt through the room. I can see my teammates standing up a little straighter, their jaws tightening, eyes locked on the AIs. They are the wild cards in all of this, the machines with the power to sway our destinies. The General nods at the robots in greeting, then refocuses on us. Dot, Sib, and I will plug into the simulation as observers, each of us reviewing your actions on the screen, as well as your heart rate, brain waves, and other physical reactions tracked by the wearable equipment. First up, she glances down at her screen. Beckett, Leo, and Naomi. My competitive instincts return at the sound of my name, and I remember the mantra that used to run through my mind before every international swim meet. Go make my country proud. I plan to do just that while I'm here. The three of us approach the chairs in front of the screen, and General Sokolov fits the VR equipment onto our bodies, attaching the bulky white rigs to our chests and strapping the elastic LED markers to our shoes. I slide my hands into the haptic gloves, watching the palm sensors light up as I stretch my fingers. Last is the headset, a wireless black and white mask of machinery that promises to immerse us in virtual space as soon as the General gives us the go-ahead to lower it over our eyes. She points to the joysticks found on our armrests. When the simulation calls for you to use your jetpack, you'll trigger the thrust with your joystick. As you know, jetpacks are self-rescue devices filled with propulsive gases. Wearing one of these manned maneuvering units on your back is like having a power you can access whenever you're in need, the power to essentially fly. But it takes skill to control the thrusters. She reaches for the stick, demonstrating its commands. These are the motions you'll use to ignite the thrusters, with a long thrust for speed and a smaller thrust to steady your direction. Dot and Sib cross to the console rig behind us, and I can hear the low hum of their machinery as they stand near me, like an AI form of breathing. Dot and Sib plug into the sim, General Sokolov commands. Copy that, the robots answer in unison, and my skin prickles at the surreal sound of their voices. It's the first time I've heard them speak, and I never realized until now that Sib is programmed masculine, Dot feminine. Finalists, lower your headsets to your eyes in 3, 2, 1. Remember, we aren't expecting you to know exactly what to do. We're looking to test your instincts. I catch one last glimpse of Asher, Katarina, and Suki watching us with rapt attention.
and then I slip the mask over my eyes. A cry of amazement escapes me as I look up to find myself floating in an inky black sky.